So moving on from the count of mitzvos in the Torah, you know, we're now in the section of the Torah dealing with the sacrifices as we discussed the past few weeks. But there are some interesting laws and mitzvos which surround sacrifices, which we should discuss. The Torah, it's the book of Vayikra, chapter 2, verse 11, it says, any meal offering you offer to Hashem should not be prepared leavened, for you shall not cause to go up in smoke from any leavening or fruit honey as a fire offering to Hashem. So the Torah at this point prohibits two things to be offered ever in an offering. Leavening, things that are chametz, like a Pesach. And also, the Hebrew term used here is devash, which we translate usually as honey. Authorities discuss that it may not only mean bees honey. I mean, honey in the Torah is actually interesting. When you hear the word devash in the Torah itself, usually it refers to date honey, not bees honey. But it's also inclusive of bees honey as well in many contexts. So authorities say here, we're not only discussing honey as we would refer to honey from a bee, but also honey from fruits, you know, fruit juices, nectars, things of the sort. And when you talk about Israel being the land flowing of milk and honey, that phrase refers to date honey. It doesn't refer to bees honey. I mean, Israel is known for its dates, not known for its bees, to my knowledge. So it's a land where they had many, many date palms. And it still has many date palms. And they have, you know, date palm orchards in Israel. So the land flowing of milk and honey. And actually, the milk there refers to, I believe, goat's milk, not cow's milk as well. But because the goats were a main product of Israel. But so when the Torah prohibits us from doing two things on the altar, you can't offer chametz, leavening, on the altar, and you can't offer honey, fruit juice, fruit nectars, etc., on the altar. The next verse says that there's one exception. You shall offer them as a first fruit offering to Hashem, but they may not go up upon the altar for a satisfying aroma. I mean, there's one exception to the concept of not offering leavening on the altar, not offering chametz on the altar, is on Shavuos. On the holiday of Shavuos, there was an offering referred to as a shtei lechem. There's two breads which were offered as an offering, and those two breads were made of chametz. So that was actually an exception to this rule. And I think we discussed that maybe this year, last year on Shavuos time, that exception, but there was an exception to this, which I'm not going to get into today, but there is an exception. There's one more exception, which is the loaves. We discussed last week the Karban Todah, the Thanksgiving offering. Thanksgiving offering came along with 40 loaves of quote-unquote bread. Of those 40 loaves, some of them were matzah and some of them were chametz. So that was another exception to this rule. But in general, every single other flour or bread offering offered in the temple was not actually leavened bread. It was unleavened bread. It was matzah. That's what it was. So that's an interesting thing. So not only on Pesach, but year-round, they would often use matzah in the temple. The next verse then says another interesting halacha, another interesting mitzvah, which is that you shall salt your every meal offering with salt. You're supposed to salt your offerings. You may not discontinue the salt of God's covenant from upon your meal offering. On your every offering shall you offer salt. There's a mitzvah that every offering offered in the temple has to be salted. In general, Jews seem to be a little into salt, not so healthy, but we salt our meats to remove the blood. That's the classic way to kosher a chicken or beef, is to salt to get the blood out. I guess traditional Jewish foods are kind of salty. You know, Jews are into their salt. But there is a mitzvah to have salt on every offering offered in the temple.
Does that relate to putting salt on Shabbos?
Yes, it does. I'll talk about that, but it does relate to that. Good. Very good connection.
Yeah. Is that only for the meat, or is there flour and water or flour oil?
So the flour offerings as well. Flour offerings got salt. The meat got salt.
What about the incense?
Incense did not get salt. So the exceptions were the incense didn't have salt. The wood didn't have to salt the wood that was burned. That didn't need salt. And also the libations, the wine and water libations, did not need salt either. But the flour offerings, the meal offerings, and the meat offerings, the bird offerings, all were salted. So I want to discuss these, you know, three different items which are regulated in terms of the temple service. We shouldn't have leavening on the altar. We shouldn't have honey on the altar. We should salt everything. That's what we see here. So you have to understand, you know, what are these mitzvahs? What's the message? What's the symbolism which they carry within? It's very interesting because we prohibit using honey in offerings. Yet the rabbis tell us, in terms of the incense, it says, had they added honey to the incense, the smell would have been so pleasurable, we couldn't even like tolerate the pleasure. It was such a delicious fragrance that people would just be like flocking to it. That would have added so much to the ketores, to the incense offering. But the Torah prohibits putting honey in. But had they put honey into the incense, a person couldn't stand before the smell. It would be such a great smell. It would have been the greatest smell in the whole world. That's what the rabbis tell us. So we have to understand that. Now, as an aside, there is a message to that. The a great Hasidic Rebbe is quoted as saying, I'll put it in other words, but the concept that she explains is that, you know, there's some things in the Torah which in our minds seem to be like, wouldn't it be so great if we could do this? If I could add honey to the incense, it would be the best thing in the world. It would be the greatest aroma. We would all love it. It would have been the greatest fragrance you could imagine. But so, in a lot of times, in terms of serving God, we think in our own minds, well, if I was allowed to do X, Y, or Z, if I could change my Shabbos around and do, you know, this on Shabbos, or if kosher food allowed for this, or if a holiday allowed for this, it would be so much better, richer, more enjoyable, even in a spiritual sense. You know, it would have been, I could serve God better that way. You know, if Jewish law allowed us to create a concert in shul every Shabbos and get up there with guitars and drums and make a whole big, you know, which strict halacha prohibits, you can imagine how much greater our services would be. And the answer is, well, maybe yes, maybe no, but something that God prohibits is not what God wants. You know, God has a will. God's will is, I don't want honey on my altar. We'll have to discuss why that is. But even though the fragrance of the incense would have been so great and so aromatic, had they put in honey, God says, as beautiful as you think it is, based on your human mind is limited. God, I understand all. And I'm telling you, that's not appropriate for the altar. That's not what I want. That's not my will. And we have to see things, we have to understand the Torah is looking at things from God's perspective, not our own perspectives. In our perspective, we'd say, let's add honey. It'd be great if we add honey. But God's perspective is no honey. And the truth of the Torah and the message of Torah and the lesson of Torah is coming from God's eyes, not from our own eyes. So let's look through these, you know, piece by piece and understand exactly what each mitzvah symbolizes. So let's start with the concepts of not putting in chametz or honey into our offerings. So we always try to go from the more simple to the deeper understanding. So we'll start with the Rambam again, Maimonides. If you picked up on the pattern in terms of the Rambam's understanding of mitzvahs, very often he connects it to idolatrous practices, and he says that what the Torah is presenting to us in mitzvahs is in order to counter idolatrous practices which we had in those days. As I mentioned before, God's trying to wean us off of idolatry as Jews leaving Egypt, you know, as the monotheists of the world at that point. So therefore, the mitzvahs he gave are mitzvahs which are coming to counter idolatry. So Rambam says that it was very, very common that idolaters, when they were giving offerings and sacrifices, would offer leavening, would offer chametz. They would all mix in honey into their sacrifices. They would want to make it sweet in that way. And therefore, God prohibited it for a Jew because we're trying to wean off of those practices. That's the very simple understanding of the Rambam, as the Rambam commonly does. He gives us a very, very basic understanding connected with idolatrous practices. We've seen that throughout many, many mitzvahs we've discussed. The great commentary, the Abarbanel, one of the great sages of Spain, he was there as the Jews were expelled from Spain. He was the rabbi who proceeded over the expulsion, more or less, and he was there to support the Jews and to encourage them when they were expelled from Spain. Abarbanel writes, very interesting thing, he says that if you could put honey on the sacrifices, you're causing a big obstacle for the Kohanim. Because what happens, you know, they're dealing with the meat, and they get honey on their fingers. And it's very tempting to lick off the honey. That's what he said. And to eat of a sacrifice in a way which is not called for is a very severe violation of halacha. You're not allowed to eat from sacrifices unless it's the part you're supposed to have. But if the Kohanim are touching all these, you know, sticky honey sacrifices, besides the fact that they're dirty anyways, that's not the issue, but the issue is they'll lick their fingers, he says. So therefore, the Torah prohibits honey on sacrifices in order to help the Kohanim not stumble over this halacha of benefiting from sacrifices in an inappropriate way. So that's a very interesting understanding. He also points out, Abarbanel, that if sacrifices could be brought as chametz, it would delay the sacrifice, because chametz requires time. Now, as we know, matzah has to be cooked immediately. For something to become leavened, become chametz, you give it time, you have to wait, and then it rises, then you bake it. So we always want to act in the Beis HaMikdash function, the functioning of Beis HaMikdash is done very, very quickly, diligently. We want to show God where we're rushing to do your service. And we have to sit around waiting, okay, when's this going to rise so I can bake it and give it as a sacrifice? That would delay the sacrifice. We don't want any delays. So Barbanel gives, again, two very rational reasons, two logical reasons as to why we would not want leavening or honey in our offerings. Now to move to another message, we have some deeper messages here. The Sefer HaChinuch, which we often quote, which again is a book which he discusses every mitzvah, gives you some of the laws, gives you some meaning behind it. So he says that, you know, the purpose of an offering, as we mentioned in the past few weeks, is supposed to be a message to the person. The person is supposed to give an offering to God. We said maybe you're supposed to see yourself vicariously being burnt with an offering. You recognize your own lackings. You recognize the fact that physicality is meaningless, and what really has eternal meaning is the soul or the intellect. So the message of a sacrifice is always for the person to gain some sort of insight from it. So he writes that, as we know, chametz, the idea of leavening, has many negative connotations in Judaism. We know in Passover we spend a week and we avoid chametz like the plague. We don't go near it, we don't use it, we get out of our houses, we don't eat it, we don't benefit from it. And what's the negative connotation of chametz? So there's many explanations to that. Thank you. I'm just going to have it straight, but thank you very much. So one idea is that chametz represents laziness. Like we said before, chametz means you delay. The way that matzah works is that if you ever see a matzah bakery, it's rushed. You know, that everything has to be done quick, get in the oven, get it out of the oven, 18 minutes is up, okay, clean all the equipment, do it again. They're moving fast. Because matzah represents action, represents diligence, represents, you know, enthusiasm. You're working very quickly. Chametz represents working slow, you know, I'm lazy, I'll get around to it, let it rise. That's what chametz represents in a person. So when it comes to serving God, you know, there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says one should be, you know, light like an eagle, run like a deer, strong like a lion to do God's will. I mean, there's a concept of diligence. When we serve God, we're supposed to do it with the most enthusiasm we can, in a quick way, obviously carefully, but quickly. You know, we shouldn't be lazy, shouldn't delay, shouldn't dilly-dally. We got to do what we have to do. If you do a mitzvah, you should run through your mitzvah, be excited about it. So the message of putting chametz on the altar would be that laziness is acceptable. That when you're serving God, it's okay to wait around, go slowly, you know, not be diligent. But the Torah says, no, you can't do that. The altar, what's appropriate for the altar is only matzah. Only something which requires diligence, quick working. We call it in Hebrew zrizus, the idea of zrizus, of acting fast. And that's what is appropriate in serving God.
What's that word,
zrizus? Zrizus, I guess, Z-E-R-I-Z-U-S, I guess would be the English way to spell it, zrizus. Means to, let's call it diligence or quickness, acting quickly. Yeah. So that's the concept of chametz. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that not offering honey and fruit juices and nectars, etc., on the altar is to teach us another lesson about life. He says that a lot of people spend life chasing after sweets. He means literally. He means that, you know, we look for food which we think tastes really good. As we all know, good-tasting food often is not healthy for our bodies, not good for our lifestyle. Too much junk food, too much chocolate, you know, those types of things. Even in their days, they're well aware, and of course God is aware, that's unhealthy. So, rather, we actually discussed this a little while back, how is a person supposed to eat? Supposed to think about food which provides strength, makes you healthy, is positive for your lifestyle and for your well-being, not just what tastes good. You know, that's how a person's supposed to act. He says that God is telling you, don't offer honey on the altar, because I want you to understand that life's not about chasing after sweets. You're supposed to offer. You're supposed to eat that which is beneficial to your well-being, not just what tastes good. Obviously, you should enjoy your food, appreciate what God gave us. You know, we make a blessing appreciating every single morsel of food that we eat, which I'm going to do right now. But blessings. But ultimately, our job in eating is to eat for our well-being. That's how we should live. So the goal in eating isn't the pleasure which comes from it, but it's the nutrition. And he says overall, you know, physical sensations, if that we look at those, any physical pleasure or sensation as a goal, that's a negative. Physical pleasure is supposed to be looked at in Judaism as a means to an end, never an end in and of itself. Whether it be eating, whether it be relationships between men and women, but any sort of physical pleasure that one has in life is supposed to be something which is a means to an end, but it's not the goal. It's never the goal. So if we look at, some people look at, you know, eating sweet food is, you know, what they live for. You know, people live to eat, right? You eat to live to eat, as they say. So the prohibition of offering sweets on the altar, not to use honey and fruit juice and the like, which I guess were the sweets of their days, before they had artificially manufactured candies and the like, you know, So that's the message to us of how to eat in a healthy way, and an overall message that physical sensations are there not as a goal, but as a means to an end. And everything in its right measure and place is appropriate. And there are times where we should enjoy good dessert and enjoy sweets and have a good piece of candy. And there's times which it's appropriate and called for, and it's important. Let's just take a very simple example. There's a very widespread custom amongst the Jewish people that when a kid is young, and you want to first teach them how to read the Hebrew alphabet, so many people have a custom, they put honey over the letters of the alphabet, and the kid looks up the honey, and you teach him Aleph. You know, looks funny, teach him Beis, Gimel, Dalet. And you're showing the kid that, you're using the honey as a tool. So the sweets are there as a tool to teach the kid that there's something very special here. Learning the Hebrew alphabet is a very important part of your life. Hopefully learning the study of Torah will be an important part of your life. There's a reason that we give kids, you know, sweets on Simchas Torah and the like. And for adults also, God says you should make for yourself a beautiful Shabbos meal. You should have foods you enjoy. Dessert's certainly appropriate, but it's not because my goal is dessert. My goal is to appreciate Shabbos. And I appreciate Shabbos through the food I enjoy and the company I enjoy and what I do on Shabbos. But my goal is not the cake. My goal is that the cake should help me appreciate Shabbos more. And obviously there's many more examples of this. But that's the idea. So avoiding honey on the altar, showing the honey is never my goal. Sweets aren't my goal. Honey is supposed to be a means to an end. But the altar is trying to show the finished product. The altar is, I'm offering this to God. This is what I'm presenting to God. So my goal is not the sweets. My goal is something different. The Sefer Chinuch also writes that chametz, and he says honey as well, represent arrogance. Chametz is something which is bloated. It blows itself up. You know, as we can say, it's full of hot air. You know, it's something which is bloated. That's what it is.
Chametz
represents arrogance. He says about honey as well. I'm personally not clear as to why honey represents that. So that's something we can think about. But certainly chametz, we understand. Chametz, the matzah is very simple. It represents humility. Chametz, something which has had time for, it has air inside and it blows up. That's what chametz is. And it's the opposite. We understand arrogance to be the polar opposite of the service of God. Serving God as a Jew means that you recognize your own personal dependence upon God, that you're humble. You understand everything is in God's hands. Nothing is really in my hands ultimately. And the more humble we are, the more we let God into our lives. If a person is arrogant, a person is saying, it's all about me, it's all in my control, I can handle it on my own, I'm independent, I don't need anyone else around. So that also reflects upon God as well. I don't need him either. And that's ultimately what the feeling of arrogance brings a person. So chametz represents arrogance. And when God says, I don't want any chametz on my altar, he's saying that you have to understand that the trait of arrogance is the polar opposite of what I'm looking for in a Jew. I want a Jew to recognize, that to have humility. You know, a person we look at as, I don't know, if the greatest or one of the greatest Jews of all time was Moshe. And Moshe was the most humble of all men, the Torah says. The greats amongst the Jewish people, those people we view as our greatest sages and our greatest leaders, you know, one of their hallmarks always is humility. People are always shocked to see how does a Gadol Hador, the greatest sages amongst the Jewish people, how do they live? They live in very, very simple surroundings, very simple apartments, very simple lives, because they don't feel they have to show off, you know. And certainly, you know, if they wanted to, people in a second would buy them fancy cars and fancy houses, but it's humility. It's all because of God, not because of me. I don't deserve anything. Whatever I've accomplished is because God has allowed me to accomplish it. And therefore, they can recognize their dependence upon God and their own personal humility. So chametz is supposed to represent to us arrogance, matzah is humility, and therefore God says, I don't want any chametz on my altar. Then another commentary, the Baal HaTurim, another famous commentary on the Torah, he writes, and this is a common explanation given by many other commentaries as well, that chametz, in a general sense, represents the Yetzer Hara, our drive towards evil that we have within us. There's a story in the Gemara, in the Talmud, which I think I have shared this story here on Pesach time, but we'll share it again. The Gemara talks about the prayer said by Rabbi Alexandri. You know, it just says an aside, you know, many of the great sages were called Alexander at the time, which is not a Jewish name. It's actually, you know, Alexander the Great was where that name came from. But there's a famous story which goes, that the Talmud relates, that Alexander the Great, as he was conquering the world, he approached Jerusalem. And the great sage Shimon HaTzadik came out to greet him. And he was ready to conquer Jerusalem. And when Alexander the Great saw Shimon HaTzadik, he was stunned. And he said, I've been seeing you in dreams before every single battle that I've won. And he's been having these dreams where every time he won a battle, Shimon HaTzadik would appear to him in the dream and tell him he's going to win the battle and predict it for him. And when he saw Shimon HaTzadik in person, he decided to not destroy Jerusalem and to back off. And because of that, many Jews, I guess, in appreciation to Alexander the Great, showing his kindness to Jewish people, named their children Alexander. And that became, and even to this day, Alexander is actually a Jewish name. You have people whose Hebrew names are actually Alexander. You know, maybe some of you have the name or know the name, but you know, Alexander became a Jewish name based on that. So Rabbi Alexandri, I guess he had it as Alexandri, but I'm sure it's the same, you know, same source. He had a prayer, and he said that really, God, our goal is to do Your will. What's preventing us from doing Your will? He said, it's the Shibu Malchios, the fact that we're subject to other nations in exile, and the Seor Shabisa, the yeast inside the dough. That's what he says. The yeast in the dough prevents us from doing Your will. And the commentators all explain the yeast in the dough is symbolic of the Yetzer Hara, of our inclination towards evil. And why is it symbolic of the Yetzer Hara? Because, you know, I would suggest that, like we said before, the yeast in the dough is something, chametz is something which is really the same ingredients as kisim matzah, but it's become bloated, and all that's really come into it is more air. So it's kind of an illusion. It's the same exact ingredients as matzah, but it presents to you this illusion of something which is much more than matzah. And evil in this world, when we're drawn to doing things which are wrong, it's also an illusion. We think we're about to do something really good, something really enjoyable, something good for us in the long term. And really, it's all an illusion, because in the big picture, it's meaningless. Now, if a person, let's just give an example. Now, a person decides, let's take an extreme example. A person is going to steal, right? And a person says, you know what, and everyone rationalizes. So, you know, I need the money, this person's already wealthy, and I need the money because I need to support my kids. I need the money so I can, you know, you can even make it religious. I want to be able to afford food for Shabbos. I want to be, you can say it in many, many ways. And either way, the person's not going to miss it, because anyway, they're so wealthy, so what's $10,000 when you're a billionaire? It makes no difference. And ultimately, it's an illusion, because stealing is an absolute wrong, according to the Torah, no matter what. And ultimately, the person will pay for it, and God's going to make sure they get their just rewards for violating the Torah. But in the person's eyes, it looks like a great idea. And it's going to bring them pleasure. It's justified. It makes sense. That's the Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara is able to blow up things to make them look, as an illusion, look like they're attractive, but yeah, it's full of hot air. That's what it is. We say in the prayers on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, one of the quotes is that all evil should vanish like smoke. Because evil in this world is really, it's smoke and mirrors. You know, it appears to be real, but it's not. So we actually say in the prayers, it should vanish like smoke. Ka'ashtan tichle, it should all vanish like smoke. Because in our world, it looks real, but really there's nothing there. So that's what, chametz represents the Yetzer Hara, because Yetzer Hara is supposed to show us that these things seem to be appealing, but really, it's a joke, it's a fantasy, because they're not appealing. Really, in the big picture, they're wrong. But in the small picture we have in our daily lives, they look like they're right. So the Bala Turim writes that the Yetzer Hara, something which represents the Yetzer Hara, obviously should not be offered on the altar. God's telling you this is all smoke and mirrors, it's an illusion, this is not good, this is evil, and this should not go on my altar. That's what it's symbolic of. Honey as well, he says that the idea of honey also represents the Yetzer Hara, because the Yetzer Hara's job, the evil inclination's job, is to make things, like we said, look appealing to us. So he says, it's so sweet, it's going to be so pleasurable, it's going to be so good for you. That's how he tries to convince us to do the wrong thing, and that's what we go through in our minds. You look at the very first instance of sin in the Torah, when Eve eats from the tree of knowledge. So what does she say? You know, the tree looks so appealing to her. You know, it looks sweet. It describes how appealing it looked to her, because it was like honey. It looks so sweet and good for us. But yet, obviously, that was the wrong thing to do. So so you don't want to offer things on the altar which represent evil in this world, the Yetzer Hara. Other commentaries point out as well that we wouldn't really need to bring offerings had we not had a Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara is what drives us to sin. Many offerings are based on sin and atoning for sins. And therefore, if not for Yetzer Hara, we wouldn't even need to bring an offering. So why would I bring it into my offering when it's the cause of my offering? So that's another symbolism of Yetzer Hara. Obviously, this all ties into the concept of Pesach. You know, it's not Pesach time now, we've well off of Pesach. But the reason we prohibit chametz on Pesach is because chametz represents so many evils of the world. So Pesach being the creation of the Jewish people, at that time we want to remove from us any speck of evil, any speck of laziness, any speck of illusion, of fantasy, of Yetzer Hara. And therefore, on chametz, we clean out, on Pesach, we clean out all the chametz.
Is that why we also burn it?
Yeah, that's part of it. There's actually a prayer, some say they burn it, that just like I'm destroying my chametz, I should destroy the Tzahara for myself as well. Because destroying chametz is something we're supposed to bring to our minds, the image of cleaning out our own personal lives, cleaning out our own personal sins. And it's important to understand, as I said before, that the sweets of this world, even the Yitzhara, the rabbis actually portray in an interesting way. On the one hand, it's a very good thing, because God created, we're all driven towards doing the wrong thing at times, because God has created a challenge in the world. If God plopped us down in the world and there's no challenge, so then we'd be robots. So we'd all be doing the right thing, and we have no challenges. So God said, I'm going to put within you this drive to do things which go against my will. And you're going to have to struggle with it, you're going to have to fight it, but ultimately it's a positive thing, it's not a negative thing. Yitzhara is a positive thing, because it's a means to an end. It's here to give us a challenge so that we can make the decision to serve God. God wants us to choose to serve God. If there's no challenge, it's not a choice. It's obvious. We have to have a challenge. But the Gemara also explains that the Yitzhara helps us function in the world in many ways. I mean, there's a very, kind of off topic, but there's a very interesting discussion in the Talmud. The Talmud relates that, and if you read through the Torah, the Tanakh, the prophets, the Jews had a tremendous struggle with idolatry throughout the ages. I mean, through the times of the first temple and the kings and the judges, read through the prophets, every couple of years, all the Jews are back worshiping idols again. And then along comes, whether it be a prophet or a king or a judge or a leader, and brings them back to God, and things are going well, and they go back to idolatry. It's the same cycle over and over again. And we can't relate. None of us are drawn towards idols. It just doesn't, not part of our lives. Idolatry in the world is not that common. I guess, there's maybe certain religions out there which are idolatrous, but overall, idolatry is not a common thing in the world. And we certainly don't feel a pull towards it. I mean, you speak to any Jew, even a Jew who is not affiliated, it's not because they're drawn towards idolatry, they're drawn towards other things. Nothing to do with idolatry. But the Jews struggle with idolatry for centuries. So the Talmud relates that it used to be that the drive in a person to worship idols was much stronger. Much, much stronger. And we couldn't handle it. It was so difficult for us that we at least couldn't handle it. And the Yitzhar Hara would always win, and the Jews would just flock back towards idols again. And therefore, the rabbis actually, when they built the second temple, the rabbis all prayed to Hashem that he should remove from us that drive. And Hashem removed that drive. So the rabbi said, while we're at it, let's go for some more things too. So the rabbi said, while we're at it, let's also pray that God should remove the drive for adultery, for incest, the attraction between man and woman, which causes sin, should be removed as well. So God said, okay. And Talmud relates, at that point, when God removed that attraction between man and woman, the world kind of came to a standstill. People weren't reproducing, weren't getting married, chickens weren't laying eggs, the whole world, that's what the Gemara says. Because the drive to, the attraction to physical pleasure is a necessary part of our lives. So the rabbis then prayed to God, please restore it, we need it for the world. But God then, what the Gemara says, God eased the attraction towards incest. So the reason that incest is not a major problem amongst people is because God took that drive away. But the attraction of man and woman is still there. And adultery, obviously, that attraction is still there, and that is still an issue to this very day. Yeah.
How do the rabbis feel? Children have football heroes or some type of hero.
Right.
How is that accepted for a child?
You're saying that's kind of like an idol. that's your planning
kind of
in some
I
way.
I think they would say that's. I don't. Adult might say that's their hero.
Right.
And that child, if the quarterback got injured, say, oh no, guess what? He got, it might be very emotional. So was that something we have to pay attention to?
I personally feel that it is, because you want your kids to look at role models of people who you would like them to emulate. And the person who's good at football, many times their lives are not moral, not ethical, they're not good people. You read these stories all the time about these sports heroes who are arrested and they have these girlfriends and they're adulterous relationships, all these terrible things. So you want your kids to look at role models, people you want them to actually try to be like. So if you could find a sports hero who's actually a clean, moral person, which these days seems to be kind of rare, so then I have less of an issue with it. But the problem is that the people, that they're appreciating how well they can shoot the basketball, but if you look at their lives, a lot of them are scum of the earth. So that's where I would really draw the line. So at that point, God eased up the drive towards incest, but yet the other drives were back in the world. But the drive towards idolatry was taken away. But the point being that drives towards the physical are very important in our lives. You know, people who don't have an appetite don't eat. And people who don't have have an attraction to the other gender won't marry and reproduce. And then the world would come to a standstill to some degree. And there are people out there who have illnesses and they don't have appetites. And it's actually very dangerous because then they can starve themselves to death. So it ultimately, like we said before, we should view these things as a means to an end. But it's not the goal. The goal is not the eating. The goal is that eating should make me healthy. The goal is not the attraction of women. The goal is that we should create a relationship which can create children, which can get down more godliness into the world. That's the goal, to create a good Jewish home. It's not the physical pleasure is not the goal. It's just a means to an end. So that's the idea. If you were to offer the chametz or honey on the altar, you're saying this is a goal. This is what I'm aiming towards. And really, we have to understand these things are all important in the world as a means to an end, but this is not the final product which should be offered up to God. So that's the discussion of honey and chametz and leaven. Now, we said that there is a concept that you should salt everything. Right? Salt should be offered on the altar, and everything has to have salt. And they would salt things well. The rabbis teach us that there is actually a few different salt storage chambers in the temple. They had to use a lot of salt. So they really had a lot of place to store salt in the temple grounds. You know, so they had, I think it was three different places they would store salt in the temple, large chambers of salt. And the halacha was they had to salt the meat on both sides. So you'd actually salt both sides of the meat. And everything got salted. Like we said, besides the libations, the incense wasn't salted, the wood wasn't salted. The blood they sprinkled wasn't salted either, but all the meat offerings were all salted. And when it comes to the flour offerings, it was a deal breaker. If you forgot to salt your flour offering, it was no good. If you forgot to salt your animal offering, it was still good after the fact. If you forgot to salt your meal offering, it was disqualified. You had to bring another meal offering. So that's how important the salt was. So again, Rambam Maimonides points out, like we said before, that the idolaters, they would not salt their sacrifices. Particularly, they would make sure not to salt them, because the salt, as we know, absorbs blood, and they wanted all the blood to remain intact in the sacrifice. So the reason that we salt our meat to this very day is to remove the blood, because the Torah law prohibits eating blood. But even on the altar, we do the opposite of the idolaters, and we salt it to show that we're not going to follow their practices. That's what the Rambam says. Someone pointed out, I think Judy pointed out before, that the salt that we're supposed to have on the table, particularly people doing Shabbos, really there's an idea, we're going to have salt on your table. People seem to be more careful about it on Shabbos, but there's an idea to have salt on the table all week long. Salt's considered part of the covenant between us and God, and the idea is that the Jewish table should be viewed as an altar. And when a Jew sits down to eat, and eats appropriately, so what you're doing is you're doing a holy service to God, because you're trying to give yourself strength in order to act as a Jew and serve God. The Gemara tells us that if you have a Torah scholar in your home and you feed that person, that's as if you've offered a sacrifice. Because what does he do with the energy that he gets? This great Torah scholar, what's he going to do after he eats the meal? He's going to go out and serve God. He's going to do mitzvahs, to teach Torah, he's going to help people. And therefore, that is equivalent to offering a sacrifice. So in our tables in our homes, if our table is equivalent to an altar, having salt on the table is symbolic of the altar, where they would salt everything.
But in the Sukkot, we were using honey during the whole Chag, right?
True,
so
right.
So was there a reason we switched from salt to honey?
Well, that's a good question. The reason that we dip it in honey in the beginning of the year is a symbol for a sweet year. That's the idea. But really, one should have salt on the table as well, even at that point. Even if you don't use the salt, it should be there. I mean, in terms of the halacha, it's kind of having salt on the table. The fact we dip in salt is a Kabbalistic concept, which is which people do, but the dipping is more of a Kabbalistic idea. But salt should be there on the table. Even to the point, there is a quote from, I forgot where the quote originates, but it says, the Jews are sitting down to eat, and everybody's waiting around to start the meal. And people are wasting their time. No one's performing any mitzvahs. So God's going to say, my people are all wasting their time. What are they doing? But the salt's there on the table to our merit. Because when the salt is on the table, that's our merit, that we have a covenant between us and God, and that, our table is equivalent to an altar, And that gives us merit at a time where we're waiting around waiting to start a meal. That's basically the quote. So the idea is, there is an idea to have salt on the table at all meals. Using it on the bread, that's a Kabbalistic concept, and that it seems to be a common concept to dip the challah in salt on Shabbos and most holidays besides, you know, Rosh Hashanah to Sukkot, we use honey for a sweet year. Besides that, salt is really what we use. What's the meaning of salt? Why is salt so important? So, very simply, many say that, you know, bland food, none of us enjoy bland food. You know, salt is the basic way which adds flavor to food throughout history. You know, salt's how you flavor food, make food more tasty. It's a natural flavor you put into food is from salt. And therefore, we should offer things to God that we would feel are pleasant to us. When I'm bringing God, obviously God doesn't eat, God doesn't taste, and God, you know, God doesn't care if it's salted or not. But when you're offering something to God, you should do it in a way which you feel you would want to offer to a dignitary. If you were to have a friend over for a meal, you're not going to serve your friend bland food. You're going to serve your friend tasty food. So when you're offering God a sacrifice, you want to make sure that sacrifice is not bland, but it's tasty. So salt gives it its flavor. And if it's an appetizing offering, in our eyes, it makes us feel it more. Because we see, I'm giving God this delicious steak. I'm giving God this delicious loaf of bread, which is so tasty to me. And it makes you more involved and more alert and more focused on the sacrifice. So you have a concept in terms of drawing you in because you're offering God something very tasty in your eyes. And there's also the concept that you wouldn't offer this to human beings while you're offering it to God. There's a quote, it's from the prophets. It's when the prophet is upset with the Jews for offering, you know, measly, weak, sickly sacrifices, he says, would you offer this to the prince? Would you offer this to an officer? Would you offer this to the king? You wouldn't do that, so why are you offering it to God? So when we offer to God, when we all offer something that we would feel is honorable, and like again, you would not serve a friend of yours or a guest bland food if they come to your home, so why would you give God a bland piece of meat or a bland loaf of bread? That's the basic idea. And for us, we have to understand that the service of God, it's a real thing. It's not just a game. So we have to be real about it. It has to be something meaningful to me. And if it's something which I would not dream of giving to a friend, why would I give that to God? And this could be applied throughout many parts of life, which is that in the idea of concept of performing mitzvahs and serving God, we have to do it in a way which we feel would be honorable to people as well. The way that we dress, the way we make a meal. You know, if you're having a Shabbos meal, it should be something dedicated to the service of God. So if you say, well, I know it's a Shabbos meal, and technically all you need to do is have a piece of challah and you've done your meal, but if you had a friend coming for dinner, you would put out more than challah. And really, if you want to make the minimal Shabbos meal, which you can fulfill halachically, so you could take out, you know, you don't need a challah, you can take a stale loaf of bread, you know, make a mozi on it, eat the little stale loaf of bread, you know, two loaves of bread, two stale rolls, but again, you wouldn't do that if you had a friend coming over. So why would you do that on Shabbos? So you have to do it in a way which is something which you feel is honorable. It's how we should serve God. One can pray, you know, if one can pray, you can put on a pair of shorts and a t-shirt, and you can pray. But again, if you're speaking to somebody of significance in your life, you would dress up a little bit more. You know, it depends on the context. I mean, obviously, Shabbos is more formal, weekdays are more casual. But if you're meeting with somebody important, you wouldn't wear a shorts and a t-shirt. You'd put on something a little bit nicer. So we have to look at the service of God as something, and obviously again, from God's perspective, whether you're in shorts, or you're in pants, or you're in a skirt, or you're in a suit, or you're in a dress, whatever you're wearing, from God, God sees through it all anyways. I mean, it's funny to think about it, but you know, God knows what's under there, and God sees how you're dressed. But you have to act towards God, from our perspective, in a way which you feel is respectable. And therefore, you don't serve God bland food, and you don't, you know, you have to make sure that a meal which is dedicated to God is a nice meal. And you have to make sure that the dress that we wear is the proper dress when we're confronting God, et cetera, et cetera. But we can all apply it in different ways in our lives. But we have to look, we have to see things from our perspective as honorable. So we're told you have to salt your sacrifices to make sure that they're tasty and they're not bland. That's what Sefer HaChinuch writes. The other point about salt is that salt, it preserves food. Classically, you know, before refrigeration, before canning, before they had the ability to freeze dry, how they preserve food, they salted it. You know, we still have jerky. You know, you get any gas station, you have the jerky for the truck drivers to take with them on their long trips. And because salt preserves food.
And
what?
It's you owe.
It's what?
It's you owe.
It's you owe?
Oh,
you owe. Right.
Which,
no.
I think so. Yeah.
Salami is.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, hard salami. It's also the salted. It's the so the idea of salt preserving food, and also it prevents spoiling, prevents rotting. So the symbolism is you're offering an offering to God. An offering, number one, it keeps the person from spiritual decay as well. It preserves you. You know, we all have our own spiritual decay. And sometimes, you know, we fall into routines and we're not acting as we'd like to act. We're not performing mitzvahs like we'd like to perform them. We're not serving God in ideal ways. We try, but we have our ups and downs. And the idea of an offering is supposed to bring you closer to God, inspire you, help lift you up, and prevent spiritual decay. That's what you do. So, therefore, you salt the sacrifice as a message to ourselves that we shouldn't be decaying spiritually either. Salt prevents decay and prevents spoiling. We shouldn't spoil and we shouldn't decay. It also teaches us the permanence of the service of God. I mean, things we do in this world, things which we do for ourselves, physical things, you know, those are limited. You know, once they're over, they're over. Things we do for the service of God are eternal. They last forever. So an offering, a sacrifice, you salt it, and you're giving yourself the message, just like salt preserves, so too my service of God is preserved for me. And what we'll have eternally is based on that which we do in this world. It's preserved for us eternally. It's there forever for us. So salt is such a powerful thing because it teaches us the concept of eternity, that things can be preserved far beyond that which you see in front of you. So nowadays, you know, you could compare it to freezing something. I mean, nowadays, other ways which we preserve. But classically, salt was the preservative. That's what they had. And it kept away all the decay and all rotting, which was there. Rav Hirsch points out, the Shimshon follow Hirsch, he points out another interesting concept. He says that as we talk about salt, you know, preserving and preventing decay, things which are salted essentially that are unchanged. Even decay usually is some other bacteria growing on it, some mold growing on it, it's another organism growing on the meat or on the food. Salt prevents that from happening. Salt keeps things as they are. In Hebrew, in the Torah, if you see the term Eretz Melecha, which literally translates as salty land, it refers to land that can't grow. Farmland that can't grow any product, any produce, is called salty land. Obviously, the land isn't salted, but it means that the land, it's going to remain as is. Nothing's going to change here. It's preserved. So Rav Hirsch says that the concept of salt shows us how eternal, unchanging, unwavering the Torah is. The Torah, as God gave it to us on Mount Sinai, you know, 3,000 and somewhat years ago, is something which is unchanging, is eternal, the messages are eternal, the meaning is eternal, and it doesn't change, it doesn't waver, it doesn't adapt itself to modern society in the sense that we're going to change the Torah. Rather, the Torah is something which fits into every situation in life as it did 3,000 years ago. That's what Rav Hirsch writes. Now, Rav Hirsch was living in Germany by the time of the Reform. And Rav Hirsch was a big fighter against the Jewish Reform movement. And in many of Rav Hirsch's writings, you hear how he's trying to address their concerns. So the Reform movement was trying to say, you know, Torah is going to change and adapt to modern lifestyle. And Rav Hirsch is saying, we have so many messages throughout the Torah which show us that Torah doesn't need to adapt to modern lifestyle. Torah is the eternal wisdom of God which can fit into any society no matter what. And salt, he says, is that message. Salt shows that this piece of meat is not going to change. It's going to remain as is. That's the concept of salt. So the offerings themselves represent, in many ways, the efforts of the human being, the accomplishments, the property of the human being being offered up to God. And he says that we have to understand that Torah is not flexible based on our whims or based on the times. Torah is something which is unwavering and unchanging. And through this is how we get close to God. You don't get close to God by changing Torah to fit your life. You get close to God by changing your life to fit the Torah. That's how one gets close to God. We're a couple minutes late, but just bear with me for 1 second. There's one other understanding I want to share with you. Listen, has to go. But Rashi quotes from a very fascinating Medrash. And the Medrash says a story. Again, it's a metaphor, but there's a deep meaning to it, which happened in the very beginning of creation. And the Medrash says, quoted by Rashi, if you look on the second day of creation, so it says that God said, I'll read it to you, God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate between water and water. So God made the firmament, and separated between the waters which were beneath the firmament, and the waters which were above the firmament. Don't ask me what firmament means. I'm not really sure what the English word firmament means. But the Hebrew word is rakia. And essentially, this is describing that God, there was upper waters and lower waters, And God separated the two. Now, what that exactly means, I'm not so sure. The story of creation is a story which is very hard to understand. The rabbis tell us it's one of these hidden parts of Torah, which, you know, really we can't fully understand anyways, how God created the world. But just reading the simple meaning of the verse, it says that there was water was all one, and God made a division between upper waters and lower waters. And we could say there's heavenly waters and earthly waters. There's spiritual waters and there's earthly waters. So the Medrash tells us that the lower waters are very upset. So that's not fair. You know, we're stuck down here in the physical world. Our friends, the heavenly waters, get to be up in the spiritual world. Why can't we be up there? Why are we stuck down here? So the Medrash says that God promised the lower waters, don't worry, you're going to get your chance. Because the Jews are going to offer you on the altar in the form of the water libation on Sukkot. They'll pour water on the altar, and you'll be lifted up to heaven. And also the salt in every single sacrifice, because, you know, sea salt, you know, you pull out salt from the sea. And when you salt every single sacrifice, that salt is ascending up to the heavenly world. And therefore, that's how the lower waters become rejoined with the upper waters. That's what the Medrash says. And that's what Rashi quotes on this verse that we're discussing of salting the sacrifices. So for this, the deeper meaning of this, I mean, obviously, this is a deeper concept. But does it mean heavenly waters and earthly waters? We could take it on our own level and understand that, you know, this is a representative of the purpose of creation in a certain sense. That, you know, a human being is made out of a soul and a body. And the soul is a heavenly being, and it's thrown down into this world, right? And the soul is put into a physical world and a physical body, but yet the soul is a heavenly being, a piece of God, and godliness put into our world. Very similar to these waters, which are stuck in the physical world when the rest of them is up in the spiritual world. So, but our job in the physical world is to reconnect our soul with the spiritual. So God, in our physical existence, gives us ways to the service of God, which we can connect with things which are eternal, which are spiritual, which are beyond our world, from within the physical world. So symbolically, one takes the salt, which came out of the earthly waters, puts it on the altar, burns a sacrifice, and that salt ascends to heaven. That salt's now reunited with its heavenly part, with its heavenly family, let's call it. So too, you know, as we in this world, as we connect more with God's Torah, with God's mitzvahs, with God, so we are trying to reconnect our soul with its heavenly counterparts. That's what we're trying to do. And the deep understanding of this medrash and the concept of salt on the altar is the concept that our service of God in this world is supposed to reunite us with our true spiritual part of ourselves. That's what it's supposed to do. So the first separation in the world occurred between the heavenly and earthly waters, and then we try to reconnect those two worlds through offering to God the water libation on Sukkot and the salt on the altar. And in our daily lives, in our own personal way, you know, our soul is separated from the heaven and it's put into a physical world, and we're always trying to do what we can to reconnect our soul to the spiritual and not to let it remain here in the physical, but rather let the soul connect with spirituality and with godliness. So that's part of the concept of salt. And it's very interesting. The Torah refers to the salt as a bris melach, a covenant of salt. It's a covenant. We don't find the word covenant used too often. We know about bris mila. You know, that's the most famous covenant that we know about. The kid has a bris, that's the covenant. But the covenant of salt is something which the Torah discusses as well. And salt is such a unique concept in that it represents the fact that, you know, we have the ability to reconnect our souls with the heavenly world. From our physical existence here in a very physical world, you know, in Rockville, Maryland, we can connect our soul to eternity, to the spiritual world. So that's part of the covenant of salt and part of the message of offering salt on the sacrifices.